From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, in for Cynthia Canty. Today, political polling. Can't seem to live with it. Can't seem to live without it. What's a news consumer to do? Who can we really trust?
They should look at polling with a grain of salt, to be honest.
Then $2.3 billion. That's what Ann Arbor company Duo Security is being sold for. What is life like for a thriving cybersecurity business in the age of endless hacking?
Who knew that in, 5 years we'd be securing democracy? But in effect, that's what it's become.
And connecting Michigan veterans to the benefits they may be entitled to.
There are certain benefits I feel like are harder to find out about. And if somebody doesn't tell you, if you don't really do research, then you may never find them.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I am Zoe Clark, in today for Cynthia Canty. So recently I was talking with a pollster and another journalist on TV, Zach Gorchow. He is a friend of Stateside. And he asked this pollster what I thought was a really great question.
Does the media understand how to write about and cover polls overall?
This has been a huge concern of mine. I've been talking about it for years now in Michigan.
That's Richard Shuba answering there. He was the pollster, and he was a guest on Public TV's Off the Record.
I think there are some reporters that treat polling the way it should, which is not to predict, but to help inform why voters are moving in the direction they're moving. My concern here in Michigan particularly is there is a lot of schlock polling.
A lot of schlock polling. And it's gotten me thinking more and more about how we cover polls. So, Richard, I made you come back to answer some more questions. Welcome.
It's great to be here.
So you're the founder of Glengariff Group. You have been conducting survey research for 35 years. So I look to you. How should the media, how should news consumers look at polling in 2018?
Well, I think they should look at polling with a grain of salt, to be honest.
Says someone who makes their living doing polls.
Well, I just think there's too much attention being paid to the horse race. Mm-hmm. He's ahead, she's ahead, whatever that horse race is, and not enough attention being paid to why are voters moving in that direction. And what we try to do with our polling is inform why there is movement, why people are shifting in one direction or another. You look at the horse race because it tells you directions things are heading. But informing the voter is what public polling should be all about.
And I want to say, I don't want to do a plug for Michigan Radio, but we don't actually cover polls in our headlines. We talk about trends or look, was one candidate doing well over a few months, but we simply don't do that headline, so-and-so is ahead or, behind. And some of that you talk about simply because of the math. If you have a poll that is, let's say, 41% to 43, you say, don't even read into that. That doesn't mean something.
Yeah, 41-43, that's a toss-up race because you always have this thing called the margin of error, which in a 600 sample is a 4%. So when you have a close race, it's a toss-up. Nobody's leading.
But that's not the sexy headline, right?
No, it's not. You quoted me earlier saying there's a lot of schlock polling. It's not just Michigan. It's all over the place. And that's why I think voters need to, take some time to understand what it is they're saying. Don't put too much stock in it, and certainly don't base a decision on it.
So give us some handy things then for advice. I'm talking survey size, margin of error, whether it's through cell phones, automated calls.
Both for the voter and the media, there are some basic rules to follow. One is, who paid for the survey? If that's not disclosed, discard it. Secondly, what's the size of the sample? If you aren't told what the margin of error is, again, grain of salt time. Is it a landline and cell phone sample? And what that means is, a lot of polls these days are done robo-polls, automated polls, computer-generated to landline telephones, and you press buttons on your phone in response. But that doesn't take into account the huge percentage of voters who are on cell phones. And that's why I always say you need to know what the cell phone sample was as part of that poll.
Because younger people are using cell phones.
Absolutely. And, there's a reason pollsters don't want to call cell phones. It's expensive. federal law requires you have to hand dial that number before you can talk to the person on the cell phone. And that's really expensive compared to computer generating numbers over and over on landlines.
So I want to talk about the elephant in the room, 2016. I mean, we all were sure, right, that Hillary Clinton was going to become President Clinton because of polling. Do you think that polls and sort of how wrong they were in 2016, like, is there going to be a time when polling gets to be trusted again? I mean, there's just, it feels like folks just don't trust polls right now.
Well, you know, let's talk about 2016. Actually, the national polling was correct. It had Hillary Clinton with a very narrow national lead, which is exactly what turned out to be the case. In Michigan, it was a different story. We put out our last public poll October 11th, which was 4 weeks from the election. That poll is a perfect example of that is not a predictor of what will happen on Election Day. It is a snapshot for what was going on in that second week of October. And what we saw in Michigan was the race beginning to tighten. Probably about 2 weeks out, it started to tighten a little. And then when the Comey letter hit, that race changed. But there was very little public polling that was released after that letter. So, you know, one of the things is polling costs money, and there's not many in the media who can afford to pay the cost. So that final week when many races close is kind of a wasteland of polling. There's nobody doing it.
Richard Shuba is the founder of Glengariff Group, been conducting survey research for 35 years. Here's to another couple decades, I hope, for your wisdom.
Let's see if I can make it that long.
Or through just one more election cycle. Here's a question. How many people do you think would hop on a train from Ann Arbor to Traverse City? What if I said 1.5 million riders a year and $100 million in annual revenue by 2040? Well, those are the numbers projected by Groundwork Center for Resilient Communities. It's a nonprofit based in Traverse City. They crunched the numbers and have released a new study coming out just today. Jim Brookbauer is Deputy Director of Groundwork. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So break this down for us. 1.5 million riders a year. That seems like a whole lot of people.
That's right. But when you consider the fact that the market for travel to the Traverse City region is growing at about 3 to 4% a year, just in visitors alone, you can see that there's a potential market for train travel. Right now, there's about 6 million visitors a year to the Traverse City and Petoskey region. A little less than half of that's coming from the Metro Detroit region. By 2040, that number is expected to double. So we're looking around and thinking, hey, instead of having all these travelers come up by vehicle,
right,
what if we had another option for them to come up where they could potentially leave their car at home?
And I don't want to be a wet blanket here, but I think there's always this question, right, with train travel. Like, okay, so you get yourself to the train, then you get to the city, you know, Traverse City itself, but you want to go up to the Vineyards. You want to go to, you know, Mission Peninsula, to Leland. I mean, so how does that work for folks who go, look, it's great to get up there, but not everything is walkable?
That's absolutely correct. What I would imagine if when people do arrive here in Traverse City or even any of the stops along the line, Mount Pleasant, Cadillac, Owosso, Elma, that there would be a mix of transportation options created. Maybe you could potentially rent a car, you could use car share, bike share. Our public transit system is certainly improving its service in the Traverse City area. So there will be a mix of regional transportation options available to people once they arrive. It's definitely an opportunity.
Now, rail lines actually exist between Ann Arbor and Traverse City, but they need some work.
That's correct. We have a unique opportunity here with this corridor. Number one, the tracks are still in place, like you said. They're still in pretty good shape, too, and they're owned by the state. So we have this unique set of circumstances. One of the largest costs when you take on a transportation project like this, a major project, is putting down the infrastructure and purchasing the right-of-way. In this case, both of those things we have in place. The tracks right now are able to handle 60-mile-per-hour passenger trains, but right now they're mostly being used for freight traffic. Plastic products, wood products are being shipped from the northern Michigan region to places all over the country. And for that reason, the tracks have been maintained over time. There are just a few key areas that need some investment for us to really fully build regular passenger service.
So you've done this study. Now who gets to be the one that just says, okay, let's do this. Let's go ahead. Let's move this project forward.
Well, there's certainly a lot of work that's done on the nonprofit side on our end, but because the tracks are owned by the state of Michigan, the Michigan Department of Transportation certainly has a lot of decision-making power over what's really done with the tracks. Right now, the tracks are mostly leased by a company called Great Lakes Central, who again is shipping the freight products. But in order to build the passenger service, the Michigan Department of Transportation, who really owns the right-of-way and the tracks, would really have the decision-making power. But that wouldn't stop a potential nonprofit from being created that could help advance this whole idea.
And how long would something like this take to get up to speed? If we said now, let's do it, you know, today, when would someone be able to ride this in a perfect world?
Well, the consultants who conducted the study team, recommended a set of steps, which includes starting out with just startup train service, maybe for special events or what's called quote unquote excursion trains, where you're not really running on a regular schedule, but you can start to begin to test the market for train travel by putting together train rides for special events like Cherry Festival, Film Festival, or even downstate to a U of M Michigan State football game. So test the market that way and then build the service incrementally as the demand and the interest grows. And we're thinking that because the state is going to improve the tracks within Traverse City next year, that we'll be able to put together some special event trains by 2020.
Jim Brookbauer is Deputy Director of Groundwork Center for Resilient Communities. Jim, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Now, I did ask Jim at first how long a trip like this would take. He says at 60 miles per hour, it would take 5 hours. But if eventually, as hoped, they were able to get trains going 110 miles per hour, he says the trip from Ann Arbor to Traverse City would take about 3 to 3.5 hours. That includes stops. Still to come, we'll hear from the guys behind the single largest sale of a privately owned company in Michigan's history.
It's never been just about, can we be successful? Can our team be successful? It's, can we create a platform or opportunity where Duo is not just a great company to work at, but a great company to have been from?
Imagine selling your business for $2.35 billion. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. There was huge news this summer from the Michigan business world. The Ann Arbor company Duo Security announced it was being acquired by the technology giant Cisco for the tune of $2.35 billion. This deal marks the single largest sale of a privately owned company in Michigan history. Joining me now are the founders of Duo Security, Doug Song and John Oberheide. Welcome.
Thank you. Hello.
So what have the last 2 months been like?
Pretty busy. We've been working to consummate this deal. We've been working to make sure that we find the right home for all of our folks as part of this bigger company. But yeah, it's been a process of getting to know kind of the in-laws, right? Just making sure we, you know, understand how they work, understand how we'll work with them.
So that's the business side, but like emotionally, mentally, your company that you created gets sold for $2.35 billion. You guys are sitting here wearing jeans, like flannel. Like, what is that like?
Two nerds, yeah.
Yes, I was going to say two nerds. Only one of you is wearing glasses like I am. Right. So nerds unite. But seriously, guys, that's crazy.
Yeah, I don't think it's been any different for us, though. You know, the history of the company has been this just dramatic change and growth every single year. You know, we've doubled the company year over year in terms of people and roles and responsibilities for the past 8 years. So this amount of change in the organization and, you know, that kind of future amount of change going into Cisco is really normal for us. So it doesn't at least phase me in terms of that road ahead.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the actual company for folks who might not have heard of Duo. You guys started in 2009 mm-hmm. here in Ann Arbor. What was the main problem that you were trying to solve?
John and I have been in security for maybe too long, decades now, but had seen that there's just a big gap in the market in trying to solve for the needs of folks who weren't traditional security buyers. So,
and we're talking about cybersecurity here,
computer
security. Yeah. So give me an example of what Duo does.
We help defend organizations from breach when attackers these days are going after users instead of the organizations directly. You have to figure out how to design security that people can use and is not just enforced upon them. And that's been the biggest shift in security in the last 10 years, that more and more as attackers are trying to get into places, they're sending email, right, and spam mm-hmm. and phishing attacks, using targeted malware mm-hmm. to go after end users' computers and devices directly versus, say, banging on the firewall, right, sitting in front of a website to try to get in.
Yeah, so I'm thinking of, you know, the DNC cyber attacks. Mm-hmm. Like, I think it's hard probably mm-hmm. not to bring that up when you're having a conversation. I'm sure people bring this up with you all yeah. the time. But, like, so John Podesta, yep. you know, the chairman of Hillary's campaign, like, he clicked on an email that he thought was innocuous. It looked like from another staffer. Would Duo have protected him from that?
Yeah, John Podesta got what's known as phished. So he got an email that was fraudulent, and it asked him to change his password. Mm-hmm. And he clicked on the link, mm-hmm. and he typed in his password in order to change it. And it turns out that was a fake Gmail page. And the attackers got his credentials and were able to, you know, log into his account and get access to all of his emails. And so what Duo does is it strengthens that login process by not only, you know, relying on your password, which is something that you know, but also allowing you to confirm your login with something that you have, which for most of our customers is their mobile device, mm-hmm. the thing that, you know, everyone keeps on them all the time and is sort of an extension of their physical and digital, you know, being.
So, I mean, cybersecurity, I feel like we're talking about that all the time, of course, here in the news business, particularly all the time. There has to be a huge amount of competition, right, in the cybersecurity market right now. What's made Duo stand out? I mean, why did Cisco, this company, look to you and go, like, this is where it's at? What you guys have done is you know, is money.
Yeah. We helped to grow the market for security, in effect. When every business today is being impacted in some way by internet, in most cases positively, right? Now you're not just being attacked, but they're growing their businesses by leveraging the power of the internet. Every organization now, therefore, has a security problem. But very few security companies ever really focused on those kind of companies. And so when we started the company, we had a mission of democratizing security, trying to make the kinds of things that previously we had built for the world's largest and most capable, you know, buyers, banks, hospitals, and so forth, available to every organization. And who knew that in, you know, 5 years we'd be securing democracy? But in effect, you know, that's what it's become. We sort of shifted from a goal in disrupting a market that had not innovated very much to now almost a moral mission, right? Mm-hmm. That we believe that every organization deserves a basic level of protection and needs to be able to defend itself.
Yeah, every organization, no matter how big or small it is, what, you know, shape and size, it needs to embrace technology to be successful and be competitive in its own right. And it's also the demand of, you know, the modern sort of workforce, that they want to be able to use, you know, devices they love and applications that make them productive. And some of those challenges that are introduced by modernizing an IT organization or devices and infrastructure are problems that Duo can help solve. And so any organization that, you know, not only cares about security, but wants to have productive employees and cares about how they perceive an organization's kind of IT group can leverage Duo to kind of win on both sides, to protect them from threats, but also enable their productivity as they move to, you know, mobile devices, to cloud technologies, and so on.
So I feel like there is a lot of fear based around cybersecurity. Mm-hmm. Again, talking about the news, it is in the headlines, yeah. right? I think right now, if you're on Facebook, you've probably seen this latest one where you get a message from someone saying, you know, copy this, forward it to all your friends that you've been hacked, but you really haven't. And that's mm-hmm. the way, it's kind of bonkers and super meta about how folks are getting us now. The conversations are always based on fear, it feels like. Is that warranted? Is that fair that, you know, there's part of us that is so scared and yet we still keep all of our things online?
Well, I think that's one of the reasons that Duo's been successful. So there's this term known as FUD, fear, uncertainty, and doubt. And a lot of security companies will spread FUD. They'll take advantage of that fear in order to sell and market their products. You know, you need this because you're probably going to get hacked, or, you know, are you worried about X, Y, or Z? And, you know, our organization has always had a very kind of positive take on security versus leveraging that fear, ambulance chasing. When there's a breach, a lot of security companies will call that company to try to sell their products. And we'll step back and say, what can we do to help that company?
Yeah, there's a lot that organizations need to worry about, certainly, but that should be our job, right, to worry about all those things and take care of it for them. And that's really our goal. We build trust, we build digital trust, so organizations and people can do what they're supposed to do and not have to spend their time worrying about the tools, tactics, and techniques of some Russian teenager. You know, we have plenty of people on our side doing that stuff so that people can sleep easy and get their work done.
And we sort of, you know, I giggle when you say the Russian teenager, but like who are those folks right now? Like, do you have, you know, in your mind, like a group of people or sort of a, you're laughing, but seriously, like, yeah. is there a hacker that you think of when you're thinking about, you know, who's trying to get into these companies you serve? Like, is there a model of this person?
Well, there are many different groups that we know of and track and are familiar with. But the reality is that the tactics and techniques they have tend to be pretty basic. Mm-hmm. The myth of the super sophisticated nation state, you know, sponsored hacker basically being having some alien technology, mm-hmm. right, mm-hmm. with which they go and penetrate all the world's organizations mm-hmm. is exactly that. It's truly a myth. You know, a lot of this stuff really comes down to well understood techniques that work over and over again in the simplest of ways, that if we only had better hygiene and better operational security, we would basically prevent.
So if you're a Russian teenager, or you are a state-sponsored adversary with tons of resources and talent, you're basically doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. And that makes it challenging for organizations to look at, you know, what are the right problems to solve? How do I prioritize my security spend? How do I build a defensible security program? And, you know, there's folks like Rob Joyce who ran the hacking team for the NSA, for the United States government. And, you know, he said this stuff is really simple. We phish people's passwords, and we, you know, compromise their unpatched devices. That works universally no matter how sophisticated you are. And those are problems that Duo helps solve directly.
We're speaking with the founders of Duo Security, Doug Song and John Oberhide. I want to talk specifically now, really, and dig into Michigan. I've lived here almost my entire life, born and raised, have seen sort of the economic cycles, the Great Recession. Did so much to our state. It feels like we are, you know, we are on the mend, coming back. Lowest unemployment rate in the state. I guess I wonder, though, as you've seen that same cycle being founded in 2009, sort of at the depths of the economic recession, what kept you here through these cycles? What is keeping you here? I think about Silicon Valley, the coasts. I mean, what is it about staying in Michigan and staying here?
Yeah, I mean, in a word, opportunity. I think a lot of folks on the coast sort of see the present state of kind of the economy and what's happened in Michigan, and they believe that it's just a further slide into, you know, absolute decline. When we look at this, we look at the tremendous upside and opportunity that exists for a state that's, and for a city like Detroit that's come through bankruptcy and has nowhere to go but up. And so I actually love building companies during recessions. I think it clears the playing field of competition. And I love building companies in Michigan because there's just such an ethos of hard work, of teamwork, of getting it done, right? In a way that I think out on the coast, there's a lot of folks that will effectively be free riders, right, on other things that happen, or they'll get caught up in all the hype cycle of what else happens out there that's not real.
There's so much happening in, you know, in the Valley that's kind of operating at the meta level of what it's like to start a company or build a company, and it's distracting and it's time consuming to participate in that ecosystem. And you know, there can be positive benefits from it too. But you know, being in Michigan really does allow you to kind of go heads down and focus on building, you know, strong business fundamentals and an organization and a team that's not going to be looking for their next gig, you know, 6-12 months mm-hmm. Into the job. And that allows us to build an organization where we can actually invest in our people, invest in their development and growth, and, you know, have that bidirectional exchange of investment and you know, retention.
And yours is absolutely a success story, right? And I, you know, I think in Ann Arbor, particularly when you talk to business folks, Jeff DeGraff, things like that, right? It's about Ann Arbor Spark, business incubators. I guess my question, though, is like, What should, yeah, you jump in, please push back.
Well,
yeah.
I just say I think that that's one angle on it, yeah. But I suggest that there's also a lot of, and probably more, grassroots stuff that happens.
So that was going to be my question, though, is that we talk a lot about these kind of well-known groups. Like, talk to me about those grassroots efforts and what maybe the state or, you know, what can we do to make sure that those continue to be successful?
You know, there's a groundswell of new entrepreneurial activity happening in this state that we've watched over the last decade or so. And, you know, Ann Arbor is sort of ground zero for a lot of it, I'd say, in technology, mm-hmm. particularly, given the university, but also given the long history of technology here. So even before Duo, every year for the last 10 years has been, on average, a $200 million exit, mm-hmm. right, from a startup mm-hmm. company. And that creates a lot of forward success, mm-hmm. right, from folks that have been, have seen what that looks like, know how to do it, and are chomping at the bit to do it again. And so, I think in a place like Michigan where, you know, the other thing that really, I think, keeps us here and has been crucial to our success is the culture. The fact that, you know, you look at, you know, like what John was talking about, out in the valley, it's almost a mercenary attitude. People would kind of climb over their, and they do, they climb over their families and race past their friends, right, to go chasing after some new opportunity. It is a very mercenary attitude. Here, there's a sense and a pride of place that I don't think exists almost anywhere else. I was just speaking at Detroit Homecoming a few weeks ago. You know, people who are from Michigan and from Detroit particularly really are proud, right, of being from Michigan and from Detroit in a way that people elsewhere just not. You know, it's just not as much of an identity and a positivity around all that that I think continues to propel us forward. And I think that's, you know, more than almost anything else is probably one of the things that's most impactful. If a startup requires people that are looking for adventure, willing to take risks, and then looking for treasure maybe on the other side of it, I mean, that's what Detroit represents to us.
Duo is the first privately owned company in Michigan to have a $1 billion valuation. What does that portend, do you think, for the state's economy, for Ann Arbor's economy? How do you see that company's growth? I mean, I'm thinking sort of the history of, you know, Ford, General Motors, Dow, Kellogg, kind of being this sense of place in the cities in which they were born. Mm-hmm. How do you see Duo fitting in that context?
We're just getting started. We have a lot more to go.
No, come on. Figure it out. Come on. You've had since August. Let's figure this out.
I put it this way. Like my wife tells, particularly my son, who was our firstborn. Yeah. You know, being first means we have a responsibility to lead, right? And we do have. And what that means is that we do have a responsibility to reach a hand out and help others come up, right? And so I do believe that, you know, we're the first, but we will certainly not be the last. Not if we can help that. Our goal is to see many, many companies like us be successful here. And, you know, either directly or indirectly, you know, a lot of what you'll see in the years to come, I think, from you know, our team, as well as those who've ever been part of our team, will be a continued investment, right, in a shared success, right, that hopefully floats all boats here. And that's really the larger goal that we've always had for Duo. It's never been just about, can we be successful? Can our team be successful? It's, can we create a platform of opportunity, right, where Duo is not just a great company to work at, but a great company to have been from. And there will be many, many success stories, we hope, that come out of, again, this one milestone and point in time. You know, we have a long future ahead of us and hopefully much more success to come.
Let's just very quickly, what does that future look like? Or are you just so in the midst of where you are right now? But I mean, you must have some things that you're thinking about 2 years down the road, 5 years down the road, 10 years down the road.
As far as, you know, joining up with Cisco, it is that forward momentum that will allow us to serve our customers at a 10x scale. You know, we protect over 10,000 customers today. And tens of millions of users, and being able to take that to the next level kind of with that global reach of Cisco is really exciting from a Duo perspective.
I think we are seeing the emergence of a truly distinct cybersecurity sector here in Michigan. And companies like Arbor Networks, companies like Barracuda Networks, companies like Duo, and other companies that are spinning up, right? There's a new one that has some Duo alumni as founders called Sensis, which has recently spun up. We were the first, but we certainly won't be the last of these major multi-billion dollar exits. We think there'll be a lot more to come, and we hope that we'll be a big part of that when it comes to, you know, cybersecurity in this state.
And finally, cybersecurity going forward. I can't even wrap my brain around what the next hacks are going to be or what the next security is. I mean, give me an idea of what you think cybersecurity or cyber hacks or both are going to look like over the next few years. What do we have in store?
one of our investors, Matt Kohler from Benchmark, when he invested in Duo back in, I guess, 2013, his thesis really was that cybersecurity was going to be the largest problem on a geopolitical scale for the next decade. And I think that's happening right now, and I think that will continue to play out.
Yeah, when even governments can't keep their secrets and when people can't trust elections, it's a big problem. Mm-hmm. It is a big problem to solve. And so, like I say, I think it's one that increasingly affects all of our lives in ways that are very, very direct. There isn't a single person, I don't think, that doesn't know someone who hasn't lost their identity, mm-hmm. right, to some attacker mm-hmm. somewhere. And so we have a lot to do, and we hope that Michigan will be a big part of that.
That's Doug Song and John Oberheide. They are the founders of Duo Security, bought from Cisco Technology in August for $2.35 billion, although the deal is still in the works, we should say.
It's closed.
Oh, it's closed. Well, congratulations. Thank you. That's the sound of champagne bottles popping in the background. Okay, gentlemen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
One of the three proposals on the Michigan ballot would make big changes to voting rights and the voting process here in Michigan. If passed, Proposal 3 would implement such changes as same-day voter registration and no-excuse absentee voting. So we want to know what your questions are about Prop 3. Just go to the stateside page, that's at michiganradio.org, or you can call us, 734-764-7840. Again, that is 734-764-7840. Stay tuned. You're listening to Stateside here from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark in for Cindy Canty. There are about 600,000 veterans in Michigan. That's the 11th highest in the nation, according to the U.S. Census. Yet the state has consistently ranked in the bottom five states and territories when it comes to helping veterans and their families access federal VA benefits. These are benefits like assistance with finances, employment, and health care. All this week on Stateside, we'll be looking at why more vets in Michigan aren't getting connected to the benefits that they may be entitled to. Today, we have two veterans who came back from war at two very different times. Lawrence Dulf served in the Army during the Vietnam War from 1968 to 1970. Dan Patrick served with the Marine Corps in Iraq from 2005 to 2009. Cindy sat down with both of them to find out how things have changed for vets in Michigan over the decades.
When you came back home to Michigan, Lori, after serving in Vietnam, what was it like when you first got back?
This, if I can cribble a line from Charles Dickens, is a tale of two cities, the best of times, the worst of times. We know now that about 85% of those who served in Vietnam successfully integrated into civilian life, and I was lucky to be one of those. And 15% came back and were just at a state that they could not right themselves. So what did that mean for Michigan? It meant that about 230,000 of us came back and integrated, got productive jobs, had families, and 40,000 were released in the state that were just a highly visible mess with no support.
Dan, what about you? You come back after serving as a Marine in Iraq. How were things for you?
It was different. I went very early on in the war and just a few years in, so I think there was still a lot of support. I think there were people that kind of understood, maybe not exactly why we were there, but I think by that point, after seeing some things, there were a lot of people that, you know, had agreed with the initial push in. And by the time I had gotten out, I had been so segregated from the world in a way because I had gotten injured and spent the last bit of my career in a hospital unit. So by the time I came home, it was a different world. And I hadn't realized that people didn't seem to care about what had happened. And to me, it was this huge part of my life that I had just experienced and a huge part of a lot of people's lives and a part of our history and things that were going on. And I felt people need to know. I mean, don't you care what's going on over there? This is the impact it's going to have across the world. And people seem to not hold interest. So I kind of disconnected from that part of my life, and being a veteran was just a thing that I put in a drawer and, you know, let it collect dust, and I just tried to learn to become Dan again. And I just remember that feeling of I don't know that I'll ever be normal again and just trying to figure out what normal is, you know. Mm. So
what about finding a job? Here you are transitioning back to being civilian Dan, doing your best to do that. How did it go in finding work?
It was difficult. I think there's a huge disconnect at the time that I got out, and it's getting better. But, you know, we were having vets get out in record numbers. Guys were, you know, just tired from the op tempo, so many deployments so quickly. Everything from, you know, right after the surge, then they started a drawdown, and their, you know, the Army was thinning out, the Marine Corps was thinning out. And so we had vets getting out all at once. And on top of that, then you're dealing with, do you have the skills? You know, I don't know how many times I've heard the question, well, you know, what's an infantry guy going to do in the real world? There's no job killing people. And so trying to learn to translate these skills, and as well as make employers understand that, you know, these are the kind of things that are going to translate well into the business world or translate well into, you know, the retail world, whatever it is that, you know, you might be hiring for.
And as you talk with other vets that were kind of from your cohort, were they having similar experiences?
Yeah, I think it was, I mean, it's a big problem across the board. I know so many guys that I meet now, and they still don't understand how to translate certain military service into skills. And so teaching people, and like I said, learning myself that, okay, well, what does military experience have? You know, you can say infantry, but if you put that, you're probably not going to get hired. Now, if I say, you know, time management, I was great at leading people. You know, there's a million different skills that you learn in the military that build you as a person and build you as an employee. It's just whether or not, you know, people get that.
And Lori, how did that compare to your experience when you came back from Vietnam?
Well, and I have to stress that I can speak to my personal experience. And there were 2.7 million Vietnam veterans, and I'm just one of them. And my experience is not typical or atypical. I make no claims other than to report what I experienced. Michigan was, actually the entire United States, was in this big boom that went from 1970 to year 2000. Gross national product would run as high as 14%, never below 4%. I mean, we can't get to 4% today in this environment that Dan and his cohorts are trying to get work in. We had this boom. There was a desperate need for people. The way the organizations, corporations reacted to our training, they appreciated our initiative. We could identify a problem, and we would move to solve that problem. And they said, good, we need you.
Lori, how about government benefits, government assistance? What was there for you, and how difficult was it for you to access it when you got back from Vietnam?
Well, the Michigan legislature, quite amazingly, voted $500 for those of us who could submit a DD-214 form proof of service. That'd be more than $3,000 today, and that was much appreciated. But the guys who were in trouble didn't have the wherewithal to get the form in the mail and get the money. So in a sense, the people who needed it couldn't get it. The federal government had probably most notably the GI Bill. And while it's never quite enough, there's enough workaround that between the GI Bill and the work that's available, you could go to school, you could go to graduate school. And that's one of the reasons why 10 years after the Vietnam War, Vietnam veterans ended up being considerably better educated than those of their peers who did not go. An amazing fact people don't know.
How about you, Dan? How difficult was it to access services and get help doing that?
So I'll say, you know, we've once again come leaps and bounds from where we used to be. And I think, you know, I was very lucky in the sense that I did have a lot of benefits. You know, the GI Bill that Lori talks about, they had come out with the post 9/11 GI Bill by the time I had gotten out. And thankfully I had, I don't know how many, countless number of Vietnam vets that kept telling me, hey, use your GI Bill, use your GI Bill. So there were these benefits. The flip side to that is that many of them are not easy to navigate and access. And I think when I got out, and I know now that there's even programs in place for this, there's still people now that get out that have a difficulty trying to navigate the system because it's not easy. And there are certain benefits I feel like are harder to find out about. And if somebody doesn't tell you, if you don't really do research, then you may never find them. And I know so many vets that have years later have gotten benefits that they should have had since the moment they got out.
You know, we think about Michigan. Our state ranks in the bottom five states for federal spending on veterans. Why are we so low in your view, Dan?
The biggest issue to it is probably that we're a Guard and Reserve state. I don't know the answer for sure.
But what does that
feels
mean?
Like.
So why we don't, would that affect it?
Because we don't have an active duty base, I think it's we're not used to seeing the impact of the military and the impact of what our Michiganders who go and join actually means, because you don't see people in uniform very often. You don't see, you know, helicopters and jets flying over on a regular basis.
Unless you live out by Selfridge.
Yeah, that's true. But which is still, Selfridge is mostly a reserve base.
Yes,
so
true.
I think, unfortunately, and fairly, though, I will say that can't be the only reason, because Wisconsin as well is a Garden Reserve state, and they go beyond for their veterans.
Hmm. Well, Loria, what are your thoughts on why we have such a low amount of federal spending?
Many veterans, particularly combat veterans, come from either hugely disadvantaged sectors of urban centers, Detroit, for example, or they come from very small towns all over Michigan. And they return to these towns, and the economic base of these towns has collapsed. And it wasn't there in the inner cities to begin with for a long time, and probably still isn't. So I think you leapt from nothing. You served your country. And you came back home to nothing, and nothing was getting worse because they tore up the railroad. That was gone. So the lumber business was gone. So the potato business was gone. And the mines closed in the UP, and people just felt stuck. And the government benefits didn't seem perhaps relevant if you could find out about them.
If you just joined us, we're speaking with Marine Corps veteran Dan Patrick, who served in the Corps from 2005 to 2009 and saw combat in Iraq. And we're also speaking with U.S. Army Vietnam veteran Laurie Dolph, who served from 1968 to 1970. Based on your knowledge and what you hear from your fellow soldiers and Marines about their experiences in other states, how would you describe what it is like to be a veteran in Michigan right now compared to what you hear from folks in other states? What do you think, Dan?
I think as a whole, we're pretty tired as a nation. It's been a long, long road. And I think because of that, there's kind of a disconnect. And so it's hard in Michigan when you feel like, well, at least, you know, the state will recognize, or at least the, you know, local government will recognize. And I think without that being the case, there's a lot of people that feel, you know, sort of slighted. And so that is the reason that we see people leaving the state to go to other states, because there are states that, you know, go above and beyond to make sure that their veterans are recognized. And clearly that's not the reason we do it. And most of us, we really just want to see our families taken care of, or you know, even the most basic things. But I think when there is a state, or there are, you know, local governments that go out of their way to make sure that veterans are recognized, I think that does help. It does kind of remind us that, you know, people do care about what we did, because it was such a big part of our lives.
Well, Dan, you mentioned Wisconsin. So what's Wisconsin doing that we're not doing here?
You know, there's a lot of simple things that, you know, I've talked to other vets about that don't seem like a big deal, and they're really not. But it's those little things like, you know, there's states like Wisconsin, several states that do free hunting licenses and fishing licenses for veterans, you know, not just for 100% disabled, for vets, and say, hey, you know. And I don't know any vet that I've ever met personally that has ever looked for handouts. It's just the fact that states need to recognize certain things, I think. And, you know, a really big part of it is other states have programs that we have, but they're state funded. And these are programs that specifically go out and reach out to veterans to help with employment, to help with putting them on the right track, to make sure that if they have legal issues, because that's another big aspect of, you know, coming home. I think I know Vietnam vets had the same issue that, you know, there were legal aspects from people who had maybe made mistakes because they didn't have time to decompress and they had challenges. And like I said, all these things are getting better. I don't want to throw the state down and say that none of this has happened. This is just from my view when I had first come home.
How can Michigan do better by its veterans? What would you like to see change, Dan?
You know, I think, once again, like I said, there are programs out there that are doing amazing things in our state. I think that when I see programs like Buddy to Buddy, there are people over there that are doing amazing work to reach out to veterans. And they are that bridge between all these services and the veteran themselves. These are programs that go out and they have to, you know, fundraise, they have to find grants, and these are programs that should get more state support because they are making huge impacts on our veterans across the board. They are doing things like teaching these veterans how to translate their skills and, you know, helping them with any medical issues or getting benefits that they never knew they had, as well as, you know, one of the biggest things I've heard that is a complaint across the board, and this is in a lot of states, is the transition from certain training in the military to the civilian side. I know guys who were docs and corpsmen
And these gentlemen can't even get a job as an EMT. They can drive the ambulance, but they can't care for anyone because, well, we don't honor this certificate. And the truth is, these guys are doing more with less in the battlefield, stopping a sucking chest wound with what's at hand. And yet their skills aren't considered transferable because maybe somebody went to a class that is state certified, quote unquote. So I think there's a way that the state could kind of change the balance of, well, what is considered transferable? Why, you know, is there this blockage between somebody who spent a long time learning this and knows it, and yet now they have to spend a lot more time before they can even get a decent job?
So when you talk about buddy to buddy and programs like that, we've got a state agency. So what's missing?
We do. The problem with that is that while the state has, you know, taken steps forward from where we used to be, and especially from where we were at when Lori was coming home, there are also a lot of programs that are very successful, and the majority of those are not state-funded. The majority of those are nonprofits. They are privately funded. They are people that are going out and fighting for grants just to stay alive, and yet, based off of what we've seen, are far more effective than state programs.
All right. What about you?
Well, I fully agree with Dan. From my perspective, we have to do more to prepare the organization to recognize the value of the veterans we get back. These are the 85% who are not troubled, are exceptional people of exceptional capabilities, and HR departments need to get off their butts and recognize the equivalencies in training these people have received, men and women, that would be of great value to those organizations. You're talking about leadership, you're talking about innovation. Veterans identify problems, solve problems, have incredible people skills, pull together diverse groups of people and make them work on the same thing, which is the biggest deal because you have disputes in any organization, people from different backgrounds. How do you get people to work on the right stuff? Veterans can help you do that.
What are we losing when veterans don't get the resources that they're entitled to?
Well, there's a a long string, I think, answer to that question. Unfortunately, one aspect of that is I think we're losing veterans. I'm not saying that's the only reason why. Obviously, there's multiple reasons, but we are losing veterans at a record number.
Are you talking about suicide?
I am. And that's a lot of that, I think, comes with guys who maybe aren't getting all the benefits that they need or all the resources. And I'm not just talking, monetarily or anything else, but even just the health care. There is still a lack in care for PTSD and mental health. I think, obviously, we've seen through things in the civilian world, there is a mental health issue in this country. And, when guys aren't receiving the care or the benefits that they need or connected with programs like Buddy to Buddy, I think that, we're losing veterans because of that. And on top of that, I think we lose the desire for people to want to continue to serve. There are a lot of veterans that have come home that I know that have continued to serve the way they did in the military and have served their brothers and sisters as well as civilians around them in their communities and have done amazing things. And they have that desire to continue to serve. And I think there are people that when they don't have those benefits or they aren't, quote unquote, paid for their services, they kind of lose that desire to serve. And it does affect the communities, I think.
I agree with that. But the organizations lose too. Many veterans come back and they feel that the organization doesn't have a clearly defined mission, that people are not on the same team, that they in fact are undermining one another, backstabbing one another. This is not teamwork. This is not fulfilling a mission. And the veterans are very frustrated at the chaos they encounter in these organizations, and it's very depressing. The difference is the veterans know how good it can be and how they could fix it. Whereas I think people who have not served just think, well, this is just how life is, and they put up with it. So we lose the know-how of the veterans, and at the same time, we lose future veterans, not just from suicides, but the volunteer military is having a harder and harder time getting people to enlist because the example of people coming back and what happens to them when they come back is just deplorable. And, who would want to sign up for that kind of a program?
Lori Dolph, U.S. Army veteran, Vietnam combat veteran, and Dan Patrick, U.S. Marine Corps veteran and Iraq combat veteran. I hope it is not trite to say thanks to both of you for your service because it's very much from the heart, and we want to thank you for being with us today on Stateside.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much, yes.
And we continue our series on Michigan veterans tomorrow here on Stateside. We'll talk with an expert who works on the ground trying to locate vets and connect them to federal benefits.
There is a tremendous amount of work that needs to be done to assist our veterans population.
That is our show for today. I'm Zoe Clark. Thanks so much for listening.